Well, great to be with you again and to interrupt your working life to think about work before you go back to work and then face another day of work. For the ancient Greeks, work was a great curse and the great blessing was unemployment. For the Greeks, unemployment was that blessed state where one could be truly human by thinking and contemplating existence. The great loathing of the Greek philosopher was to get your hands dirty. And the great vision of a sophisticated and civilized person was someone with soft, tender hands that had never lifted a hammer to make anything happen. European civilization became quite different from that. So, especially after the time of the Reformation in the 1500s, the reforming movement of the Christian religion came to value work. At times even to idolise work, as in the Protestant work ethic, to see work as far from being something that took away from your humanity and your chances of flourishing, was rather that thing that made you truly human, that thing in which you could find your vocation and your calling. I wonder where we fit on that scale. I guess at one level all of us have probably dreamt of the joys of unemployment, in that idle moment on a Tuesday afternoon, that dream of having nothing to do, that memory of childhood of being bored and thinking, what was it like to be bored and how could I ever get into that state again? But most of us, I guess, I think, if we were suddenly liberated from our work, it is unlikely that we would use that liberation in order not to work, but in order to do other work. I take it that when we daydream, we sort of imagine those first 2, 3, 4 weeks of unemployment being a time of rest and recuperation. But after that, I think we would be driven to do something. We would think, I'm no longer employed, so now I can get on with the work that I want to do, the novel that I want to write, the painting I want to paint, or the house I want to build. Most of us, of course, recognise as well that while work may be difficult, unemployment is a kind of curse in its own, and that to be entirely unemployed and to be bored, although it sounds attractive at the minute, we all recognise on a moment's reflection would be miserable and difficult. And so I think most of us see what the Bible sees, well, at least I'll try this claim out on you, that work is not a curse. And rest is not a curse, but both work and rest are cursed. I think that's the way the Bible sees it, that work itself is not a curse, or that rest itself is not a curse, but rather both work and rest are cursed. Not in themselves things that we want to get rid of, but tantalisingly less than they ought to be. You know, you spend that week on the beach in Bali and you think, this is it, this is what I was built for, I should do more of this. Or you get to that project at work where it all kind of comes together and there's no goalkeeper in the goals and it sinks right in, and you think, work should be more like this, and I could imagine myself being fulfilled if it was like this all the time. And yet I think we recognise that rest without work would lead to despair, and work without rest leads to frustration and anxiety. And so today, for the 15 or so minutes that we have, I wanted us to think about work from the book of Ecclesiastes, and particularly to kind of take that left of centre view that this book encourages us to take, and to think about work and wisdom. To ask the question, where do you find wisdom for work? What would it be to work and to rest wisely? Now, of course, the very question of finding wisdom is a difficult one for our culture. Ancient and traditional cultures answer that question by saying you find wisdom among your elders, your parents and your village elders and so on. But if you've been growing up on Disney films or Pixar, Shrek 2, Nemo, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and so on, you know that your parents and anyone older than you is the least likely place to find wisdom. If you think about the plot of any Disney or Pixar film, it is that the father or father figure at the beginning has an idea that turns out to be wrong, and actually it's the kid or the hamster that knew what was right all along. And so instead you might go to a philosopher and ask about wisdom. The ancients would do that, the Greeks especially, because a philosopher could tell you about small business or marriage and so on. But these days it's very unlikely that you would truffle off to UWA to ask about wisdom for life. And so I think most of us are left with our friends, but the problem with your friends is that they're the same as you and they share many of the same blind spots as you, and so we struggle to find wisdom. Well, this book offers us wisdom, wisdom for work, and it's a particular kind of wisdom. It comes from the left of centre. It's the kind of wisdom, if you can come with me on this metaphor, it's like the ugly lights at the nightclub. This is a phrase, I don't know if you come across it, where, you know, at a nightclub, it's kind of 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and the lights are low and coloured, and people's makeup is still on, and the sweat hasn't totally overtaken them. And you look around, and people look happy and sensible. But there's a point at about 4 or 5 in the morning where they put what they call the ugly lights on, and suddenly it's all fluoro. And you realise that the people you've been dancing with, that their mascara has started to droop down their face, that their clothes are covered with sweat, that they smell like BO, and that you didn't look that good when you were dancing after all. And Ecclesiastes wants to bring that kind of wisdom to bear on everything, this kind of unrelenting fluoro-like wisdom, where it wants to expose life as it is in its extremities and to say, if it's like that, if that's life under the ugly lights, and particularly today, if that's work under the ugly lights, where do we find wisdom? And his central observation of life under the ugly lights is that work, like everything, is, his word, hevel. That work is misty, that it's vaporous, that it looks like it's going to fulfill you, but it doesn't quite. That rest looks like it's going to fulfill you, but it doesn't quite. And as you look for identity, for significance and security in work, it doesn't quite fulfill. If you look for it in unemployment, it doesn't quite fulfill. And so under the ugly lights, I think there's four things we can say about the wisdom to work. The first one to say is that wisdom for work is precious. The writer of Ecclesiastes, even though he's kind of on the extremes of the wisdom literature of the Bible, wants to commend to us the joy and beauty and rightness of being wise, of being clever and productive in work. He says later in the book that wisdom, like inheritance, is a good thing, that wisdom makes one more powerful than 10 rulers in a city, that the words of the mouth, from the mouth of a wise one are gracious. The teacher wants us to look at our working lives and to acknowledge and celebrate the beauty of wisdom, the beauty of what it is to know how to make things happen, how to get things done. To celebrate the idea that you can imagine a project and then implement a project and then release a project and celebrate it. And you may have noticed that when that happens, when your wisdom bears down on your work and you get things right, and a project comes to completion and it's as you intended and even better, then the distinction between work and rest actually kind of collapses. And the experience of having seen a project fulfilled is anything other than stressful or anxious. It actually feels like a kind of rest that rest itself couldn't provide you. And the writer of Ecclesiastes wants to say that that is part of the joy of being human, that ability to hack the world and to imagine and fulfill a project and to take joy, as he says, in the works of our hands. So firstly, the wisdom to work is something to be celebrated and enjoyed. But secondly, he wants to say to us, under the ugly lights, that the wisdom in work, that being successful in work, is an observation, not a promise. Later on in the book, he says in chapter 10, the fool is appointed to great heights, but the rich man and the rich... the fool is appointed to great heights, but the wise remain in lowly positions. I've seen slaves on horses and princes walking around like slaves. I wonder, without naming any names, whether you see that in your workplace, that somehow in the cut and thrust of life, some of the wrong people end up in the wrong positions, and the one who actually understands the company isn't at the levers to make things happen, and the one who does have their hand at the levers is the one that really doesn't understand what's going on and keeps pulling the wrong ones at the wrong time. If that's your experience at work, don't get paranoid if you think I'm talking about you. I certainly, I know in this august room, none of you are that, but other people are. And in this broken world, it's a reminder that wisdom, while to be cherished, is not itself a promise. It doesn't itself guarantee that in every situation the right thing will happen and the right person will be promoted. it's an important thing as you understand the Christian faith to see this, because the Christian faith makes kind of spectacular claims about our life and the way it works out. The righteous, it says, prosper and the wicked perish. But it also says that in this broken world, the opposite also happens. That sometimes the wicked prosper and sometimes the righteous perish. And one of the things the writer wants us to do is not to ignore that and just focus on the 80%, but to see the 20% for what it is and to allow it to affect the way we think about work and to loosen our grip on what is fundamentally havel and fleeting. So wisdom is not a promise, and thirdly, wisdom is not the same thing as righteousness. That is, to do the wise thing is not always the same thing as to do the right thing. In chapter 10 of the book, one of his enigmatic phrases is to say that money is the answer to everything. It's the kind of thing you don't expect in the Bible. There's very few churches in Perth that have outside welcome to St. Swithin's Church, where money is the answer to everything. There may be some. But the book gives those observations, not so much to commend them to your moral instincts, but to alert you to the way that in this world, righteousness does not always prosper. You see, in a world that is created with some order and possibility, it is possible to be efficient and not right. Wisdom can teach you efficiency. It can teach you to get your inbox to zero. It can teach you to get projects in more or less on time. But under the ugly lights, he wants us to think about the nature of work and to see that you can use efficiency to feed 6 million in East Africa. And you can use efficiency to exterminate 6 million Jews in Europe. One of the great horrors of the Holocaust was how efficient it all was. As people reflect on that horrific event of the 20th century, people are shocked not that it was just this mad rush of crazed people under an impulse, but that it was run, the Holocaust was run by organised, efficient men who wore suits and kissed their children on the way to work, who worked behind desks for a day and came home tired and put their feet up for the evening and started it again the next day, just like we do. So the writer of Ecclesiastes wants us to see that success in work is not the same thing as moral success. It's not the same thing as being someone who is a morally competent and good person. He wants us to ask under the ugly lights, if you're efficient, if you're making things happen, then what for? To what end is this efficiency and this energy pointing us? So the book says that wisdom is precious, that it's not a promise, that it's not the same thing as righteousness. But finally and fourthly, the book wants to say that wisdom for work can, in a fallen world, be a kind of rebellion against the one who created us. You see, in the view of the Bible, unlike the Greeks and unlike the excesses of European culture, work is not a curse, but work is cursed. That when the man and the woman rebelled against the knowledge of their Creator and sought to usurp him from his place in their lives, work became cursed in all those ways. It became a place that does not always reward in industry and wisdom. It became a place where the correlation between wisdom and righteousness was not always evident. It became a place where efficiency could be used for good as well as for evil. And I think, as Alain de Botton says in his book on the joys and sorrows of work, we moderns in particular, in our general move away from God, have been those who have come to lean on work at a weight that it itself cannot bear. See, it's one thing to say to work, give me something to do, help me to make my days productive and flourishing and to serve the community in which I was placed, in my industry, in my labour and so on. It's quite another thing, and a distinctively modern thing, incredibly new, like 100, 150 years old, to look at work and say, tell me who I am. To look at work and say to work, you will make me significant, you will make me secure. The vast majority of humans have not done that, and we have, and we've put a weight on work that I think it can never bear. And so the wisdom of Ecclesiastes is this. He says, when times are good, be happy, but when times are bad, consider that God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, you cannot discover anything about your future. The kind of ugly lights of Ecclesiastes is to look at work, to acknowledge its joys and its potential for flourishing in your humanity, but also to acknowledge its extreme limitations in being able to tell you who you are and whether and how it is that you matter. And he confronts us under these ugly lights to say that, honestly, we don't even know the future. Very few of us, if any of us, the Bible would say none of us, are in total control, even at the CEO level, of where the company goes. We're dependent on 1,000 forces beyond our control. And so later on in the book, the writer of Ecclesiastes says that the way of death is better than the way of life. He says it's wiser to go to funerals than to weddings, for death is the destiny of everyone, and they should take this to heart. The shocking truth at the heart of the book of Ecclesiastes is that the one thing that you and I can be certain of is that we will die. We can't be certain of our future or our marriages or our work or our success or our failures. But we can be certain that we are mortal and that one day we will face our own death. And the irony of Ecclesiastes is that he points to a world where we plan everything, where we plan to minute details our holidays and our work and our projects and our commitments and act as if like before the ugly lights come on, that we're in complete control of these things. And we've got the trip to Bali planned to perfection, and we're not ready for our own death. And the writer of Ecclesiastes says you want to be ready for the one thing that you are certain of. And the funny thing about our culture, which is so death-denying, is that I kind of feel bad saying that, like I'm saying something that's kind of bad taste, or you shouldn't really mention something like this at 12:45 on a Thursday. It reminds me of Homer in The Simpsons. There's one scene where Lisa, his daughter, is talking to Homer, and she's cottoned on to the idea of death, and she says, "Daddy, is it true that you're going to die one day?" And Lisa says, "Oh, Lisa, you and your imagination." We spend our lives aware of all sorts of possibilities and worried about all sorts of things that may never happen and never confront the thing that we know will happen. And the teacher says, fear God. The teacher says, be prepared for the one circumstance that you definitely will meet. Because we will die, and says the Bible, in dying we will meet our Maker. Now that sounds incredibly morbid for a Thursday afternoon, but the strange thing about the book of Ecclesiastes is that he sees great freedom and great liberation for your work if you can acknowledge that basic reality. Because if you can grasp that the one thing that we know we have to face is our death, and the one person that we know that we have to give an account to is God, then that liberates you from all the other accounts and all the other circumstances that may or may not happen, and all the other people whose opinions may or may not matter. And it liberates you, says the book of Ecclesiastes, to enjoy your work without holding on to it, and to enjoy your work without demanding that it bring you your significance and security. I was thinking about this a little while ago, these passages and these thoughts. It had a direct effect on me. I had a meeting as part of my work as a pastor in Mirrabooka with a person from the church, and I was riding, I've got a little scooter, and I was riding my scooter from Mirrabooka back to the church office in Shenton Park. And I had my phone in my pocket. I had it for outdoor settings, so it was quite loud. And in the time it took to get from Mirrabooka back to our church, I had 3 telephone calls I missed and 3 or 4 text messages. I'm not normally that popular, but on that particular day lots of people wanted to talk to me, and I could feel the stress levels rising, as I'm sure you do under those kind of circumstances. And I was on my scooter and I could hear the phone going and the text messages coming through, and I knew I had 3 back-to-back meetings at the office that afternoon. I thought, when on earth am I going to reply to these things? I've got a meeting that night and I've got children to put to bed before I get out, and it'll be 10 o'clock before I've even looked at the phone to see what these people wanted from me. And I could feel it rising, and then suddenly, having been thinking about this passage that morning, having been thinking about the book of Ecclesiastes, it suddenly dawned on me what should be obvious and is obvious to anyone else. I'm not God. That is, maybe God could ride a scooter and reply text messages at the same time. But I just can't. And to acknowledge that I am not God and that I am limited in my capacities and that these things had to wait because of my humanity. I wasn't being irresponsible to these people. I was just being a human who finds it really, really hard to ride a scooter and reply text messages at the same time. And I wonder if that knowledge, the knowledge, as the psalmist says in the Bible, that we are but dust and God remembers our frailty, could liberate you from that sense of bondage to the demands of work. To liberate you to the acknowledgement that for all our wisdom and joy in our work and all our successes, that we are but creatures and that we are but frail. And it might liberate you from a whole lot of guilt about things that actually you just couldn't possibly do under the circumstances and demands that just were beyond you to meet. And you could loosen the grasp a bit on work and what you demand of it so that you can enjoy it for what it is, for a wonderful tinkering with the created order, for the chance of bringing order out of chaos, without the additional obligation of trying to be a god in your circumstances, which we are not. You see, this liberation that is promised in the book of Ecclesiastes comes from the great joyful acknowledgement that there is a God in heaven and we are not him. The job description is there for God and it's already been filled and he's not taking other applicants. So you and I are liberated to enjoy our work for what it is, and to not to demand from it that which it can never give us.